I'm Lizzie Grossman, SEJ member, and thank you all so much for being here. And thanks to my panelists. And this session we've called Food Security and Public Health, Causes, Consequences, and Responses. And we have four extraordinary panelists with an enormously wide range of experience and expertise in these issues. And I think I will just set the issue up a little bit briefly with some statistics that I pulled out of some stories I was doing recently. And then I'll briefly introduce our panelists, who will each talk for about 10 minutes, and then that will leave us lots and lots of time for conversation and questions. And the order we'll go in, I just thought we would go from kind of global to more local and then back out to the journalist perspective, which is always wide-ranging from the large scale to the small scale. So we'll start with Rebecca Shaw, who's with World Wildlife Fund, move on to Zoe Gore, who is a physician here in San Francisco and is working on some really interesting initiatives. I don't mean Sacramento. Interesting initiatives with a program called the Reverse Food Truck. Then to Alexis Guild, who is with Farmworker Justice, and Rosalie Mungo, who is a television journalist with the Kenya Broadcasting Corporation in Nairobi, but here in the States on a science journalism fellowship at MIT this year. And so here are just a couple of statistics on this issue. According to the United Nations, some 795 million people worldwide lack enough food to live healthy, active lives. Poor nutrition causes nearly half the deaths in all children under five. And here in the U.S., about 50 million people are considered food insecure. About 15 million of them are children. And in the past couple of years, coming off the recession, the situation has eased a little bit. But in 2009, U.S. food insecurity reached 21%, which is the highest level ever recorded. And the health care costs of this situation are enormous, particularly for children. Food insecure children are twice as likely to experience health problems overall, nearly 1.5 times more likely to have asthma, and to have iron deficiency and various developmental delays, and these household stresses also add to physiological impacts that have both health and impacts on health and also on children's ability to learn. So this is a huge health issue, and I think I will just launch in to the panel. So, Rebecca, you can get
Great.
Us going.
Thanks. So I'm with the World Wildlife Fund, and what I'm going to talk about today is more of a global picture of health and nutrition and as it relates to the environment and environmental degradation. But I want to set a little context for that, so more stats for you, because stats are always good to put in context. Smallholder agriculture remains the heart of food production in the world. I think when you're in the developed world, you kind of think it's all about the big farmers, industrial farms. It's not. Small-scale agriculture accounts for 85% of all farmers globally and 70% of the world's food production. So if you think of smallholder farms, it means subsistence-level farming, where most of the food produced is consumed by the family, and maybe some of it is actually sold in the market for other. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Which is very. Is that better? Sorry, I was seeing all this consternation in the back of the room. I couldn't figure out if it was me or me or me. Okay. So smallholder farmers' subsistence level. So 70% of all food is produced by farmers who are working at subsistence level, may sell a little bit into the market so they can buy their other needs as well. It's true with small-scale fisheries as well. They produce more than half of the global seafood catch. So when you think about farming on the planet, when you think about food production and nutrition, you got to think about very small farms living in subsistence. 2.5 billion people in poor countries are dependent directly on these smallholder farmers for their food and nutrition. 1 in 9 people on the planet are undernourished, and 98% of those live in the developing world. So we're already not meeting the needs of the poor in very significant ways. To make a challenging situation even more challenging, then, we will need to increase food production by 70% to meet the needs in 2050. And the climate is changing, and 75% of the world's food right now is generated from just 12 plant and 5 animal species, making the global food system highly vulnerable to shocks in a time of change. So we need to figure out, which is really important for us to figure out, how to deliver a secure and nutritious food supply in ways that meet the needs of the poor, to decrease or eliminate the environmental impacts, and to increase the resilience of the food production system to the shocks we know that continue to happen and that they're on their way. So in addressing these three issues, I want to talk to you about our work on food security and conservation, and how important we think it is, not only for our mission, but for the health of people around the world. So the first point I want to make is that environmental degradation is a significant driver of food insecurity globally, and food insecurity is a significant driver of environmental degradation. So it's kind of a nasty spiral. Ecosystem degradation undermines the ability of poor communities to maintain production of food at subsistence levels. And we see crises being generated around the globe for this reason. Today, 2/3 of the planet, the ecosystems, are being used unsustainably. So much of the world's arable land is in use and degraded in some way, leaving a little room for expansion. So we really do need to be able to increase productivity on some of the lands we already have that have been degraded. And fisheries catch is at or near capacity, with over half of the world's marine fisheries fully fished and 1/3 of them of the monitored fish stocks in jeopardy. So the next point I want to make then is there's a huge overlap, as you might imagine, for the places of high poverty and high biodiversity. The World Wildlife Fund started out as a conservation of world biodiversity to protect the needs of nature and people. We are now totally concentrated on the way these two things to come together and have realigned our goals to meet the environmental underpinnings of the Sustainable Development Goals, because we figure it is so important to meeting our mission. We focus on food security in places where it is critical to our mission. In these areas, people are eating most of what they produce and catch and selling small bits, as I said before, and they do not have the resources to buy alternatives to increase productivity in ways that we see as standard in the developed world through soil amendments and other ways. Without a careful eye to over-extraction and without amendments, they need to maintain their soil fertility in ways that we don't hear in the U.S., I'll just point out. They need to maintain their water availability in ways we don't do very well in the U.S., and they need to have productivity very close proximity to where they live. If their soil is depleted, they don't have the resources to buy fertilizer. If their waters are overfished, small boats are not designed to go out further and further and further like the developed world can. Food security and healthy environment are inextricably linked. I mean, inextricably. And we know that more and more all the time. There's been a lot of lip service to it. But the more we dig in, the more we do on the ground, the more we realize this is the case. And so what is World Wildlife Fund doing in this arena? The World Wildlife Fund doesn't have this as its core capability. It has conservation as its core capability. So the best way for us to tackle this issue is to collaborate with development organizations that do it really well and really dig in on the places where we have overlapping needs in our mission for meeting our missions. So we are collaborating with CARE, a humanitarian organization fighting global poverty. And this alliance we have with CARE is focused explicitly on food and agriculture as the largest driver of terrestrial, marine, and aquatic biodiversity loss and the genesis of instability in food production. So it seeks to address two concerns: the failure of inequities in the existing food system to meet the needs of hungry people, and the negative impact that food production can have on our environment that further undermines food production. Our goals are mutually reinforcing, and we emphasize the need to manage the use of natural resources as a critical path to food security. So I want to give you some really concrete examples of how conservation interventions can increase food production substantially and provide a safety net in hard times. So those are two different, that's the increase in productivity and the increasing resilience pieces of the puzzle. We have a project in Mozambique with CARE, and after 7 years with our conservation interventions, we have seen farmers that implement conservation practices experience a quadrupling of crop yields due to improved soil health and water retention. We also see in these same communities where we have no-take zones in off the coast, we have depleted fish stocks rebound, the diversity of fish species increases, and the fishers report that the fish are more abundant and of higher weight, allowing for more catch. So that's increased productivity. We're seeing examples of increased productivity. We're also seeing that when there are extreme weather events, conservation interventions in some conditions can actually provide or at least lessen the impact of that event. In Kenya, in grazing systems, the conservation interventions enhance livestock survivorship during drought and also increased the rate at which the livestock grazing was to rebound after the drought. So the shocks to food security were shorter and less severe. In Indonesia, marine protected areas increase food security because they've just, like in Mozambique, produce more fish biomass, and the richer and some of the richer poor households actually do even better. And so this actually takes me to the very last point I really want to make, is that the outcomes, that this isn't a silver bullet. The outcomes aren't always straightforward for conservation interventions or clear, and not all poor people benefit uniformly from conservation interventions. And so one of our major goals in this alliance is to make sure that we're measuring the impacts on the poor communities and the women and children. So it is important to remember that these communities that we work with are not a homogenous group, and you really need to take be careful in measuring the outcomes to make sure that we're designing our interventions so they actually meet the goals we're trying to achieve. And that sounds kind of boring and lame to say, but a lot doesn't get measured, and there's a lot of assumptions built in. And when you're talking about feeding the poor in the world, you actually really need to be a whole lot more concrete about what you're producing. So they're not a homogenous group. Outcomes vary by community type, by resource rights distributions, by culture, by ecosystem type. And the work to monitor the outcomes of a wide variety of these conservation interventions is critical to maximizing food security in the future on a global scale. We have a lot of learning to do fast. Again, climate's changing. We need to feed more people. We need to do it on equal or less land. And one thing that I do want to point out that I think is universal, or that we've found universal in these sites where we're working closely with CARE, is that impacts are most likely to be felt, the positive impacts of conservation interventions are most likely to be felt by the most vulnerable. Females are the poorest of the poor, and when women benefit, children benefit. The most vulnerable are women and children. And so in our study, we found that the female head of households experience greater increases in food security with these conservation interventions, on average, not always. And so understanding where they don't work and on what conditions they don't work is really important. So just in conclusion then, conservation interventions have the potential to substantially contribute to food security in the future in the face of change, but we have to be really careful how they're implemented and know what the outcomes are going to be. Interventions to increase nutritious food availability will require the need to be culturally appropriate, and also with a special attention to nutrition, because one of the major trends we've seen in agriculture in the last few years is more and more calories being produced with less and less nutrition being produced. Not the way you want to go if you actually want to have healthy children on the planet. And lastly, we will need to have careful attention, again, to measuring the full suite of impacts, both positive and negative, so that we can have a greater impact in creating more food security of the most marginalized communities on the planet.
Thank you. And that's a great segue, the quality of calories, I think, to Zoe Gore. So, yeah, thanks.
That's exactly what I was going to say, that was a perfect segue. In fact, I'll pay you later, I guess. My name is Zoe Gore, and I am a pediatrician here in the community and active in the American Academy of Pediatrics. And for those of you who don't know about the Academy, we are the sort of largest pediatric organization that works on behalf of pediatricians, but more importantly works on behalf of children. And right now, one of the pillars of the Academy in terms of where our efforts are going is the impact of poverty on child health and also on family health, because those two are obviously integrally related. I think Lizzie wanted me to also talk a little bit about what we're doing here in the community in terms of trying to bring awareness to the problem of poverty and the problem of food insecurity. And one of the projects that we've worked on, and actually it was my husband's idea because he got, in all honesty, a little bit tired of me coming home every day going, this is such a problem, what are we going to do about this? And heard a story on NPR about a organization in Minnesota who was using a truck that they called the reverse food truck to collect non-perishable items and bring it back to the community. And so we started this Sacramento reverse food truck and actually have been quoted in our local paper as saying, I don't want useless calories to come to the truck, that if you're going to bring food, it needs to be something that's worthwhile, because the other epidemic that's going on, which people may not understand how the two relate, is the obesity epidemic, and that many of these children in particular who are morbidly obese are actually nutrient deficient, that they're iron deficient, that they are have other vitamin deficiencies and are obese, and then are also suffering the complications of obesity. In fact, I just last week had a surgeon say to me, there's no way that child has gallbladder disease. I said, well, actually, yes, take a look at the child's weight and you'll see that indeed the child has gallbladder disease. So we're seeing these, you know, evidence of the complications of obesity as well. The other piece, though, that I wanted to touch on is the awareness of the physician community in terms of understanding the health impacts of poverty, of food insecurity. I'll ask a question. So I'm assuming that all of you have been to the doctor sometime in the past 5 years. Yes? I didn't say 1 year because a lot of us don't go every year, myself included. So you've all been to the doctor in the past 5 years, yes? Okay. So by a show of hands or verbally, who has had your physician or nurse practitioner, if you saw a nurse practitioner, say to you, do you run out of food at the end of every month, or do you fear that you will run out of food at the end of? So those are validated measures of food insecurity, right? So that is a very good predictor of whether or not you are living with food insecurity, and yet none of us in this room have been asked if we're going to run out of food. So that either assumes that your doctor sort of made an assessment and didn't think that he or she needed to ask, or the thought never crossed their mind, which in actuality is the reality, that most physicians, myself included, were not trained to think about food as a risk factor, or the lack of food as a risk factor for health or the social determinants of health, or as one speaker I heard recently say, the social determinants of disease, because really the lack of food is a predictor of disease. And for children in particular, it's also a predictor of failure in school. So, you know, if you think about it, like right now we're approaching the lunch hour, and some of us may have skipped breakfast, some of us may not have, but and you might be hungry, and you might be a little distracted by your hunger. So imagine that you're a seven-year-old learning to read, being distracted by your hunger. It's not going to go so well. And in actuality, not being able to read by second grade is one of the best predictors of also not graduating high school and then not going on to be a successful member of our community. And so part of the Academy's mission and part of my mission here in this community with my physician colleagues is to bring awareness to the healthcare community that these are important issues and that, you know, maybe someone's diabetes isn't under control because they can't afford the healthy foods or they can't afford their medicine. And that these things need to be considered when we're sitting here going, well, why aren't you taking your medicine? Why aren't you eating what I told you to be eating? Because physicians, believe it or not, have a really big egos. So, you know, why aren't you listening to me? Well, the reality is, why aren't we listening to our patients? Why aren't we understanding that these are significant determinants of chronic disease and health? And for children, you also get the added stressor of their parents being hungry as well. And, I mean, we've all heard the hangry. And I said to my son very recently, I need to eat something. I cannot be nice right now, right? And so if I have the awareness and self-control to recognize that I can't make an appropriate decision because I'm hungry, if I don't have that awareness, if there are other factors like I need to figure out rent and all those other things, that stress on the child actually changes his or her brain and makes education and rational thought even more difficult. So I think.
Thank you. That is great. Wealth of information for lots of stories, I have to say. And now we'll go to Alexis.
And that's actually a great segue into what I will be talking about. So my name is Alexis Guild. I am the Senior Health Policy Analyst at Farmworker Justice. We are a national farmworker advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. And our mission is to improve the living and working conditions of farmworkers and their families in the United States. And the reason why I say that that is a great segue is because I think you really talked about kind of the healthcare angle, and I do a lot of work with community migrant health centers, talking about, you know, access to healthcare for farmworker families and the issues of food security and social determinants. It's all very closely related. So I'm going to take it even down to the community level. But I also want to begin with context, and I'm going to give some data, but I'm going to say that there is not good data on farmworkers. If you've ever done any work on farmworkers, you know that data is hard to come by. And there are a couple of surveys that are generally used. The one that is most recently cited or most often cited is the National Agricultural Workers Survey, which is a survey conducted by the U.S. Department of Labor. But they really only survey about 2% of the farm worker population, and they aggregate their data over 2 years. The 2014 data is just being published or soon to be published, so we're a couple years behind. And they also go to farms, those who actually survey the workers, and it's a very comprehensive survey, and those who conduct the survey do it in Spanish, in the language of the worker, try to make it comfortable, but they go to farms where the farm owner permits them to go. So there may be some bias in terms of looking at especially their health care and their income and other, you know, other issues that they ask about in the NAS. We may want to think about taking it with a grain of salt because of the way that the survey is conducted. But that being said, it is the best survey that we have. So it's estimated that, and again, lack of data, it's estimated that there are 2.5 million farm workers in the United States, about 4 or 4.5 million with their families. California, of course, has the largest agricultural worker population. It's a large farm worker state. A lot of agriculture happens here in the United States. And unlike in the developing world, the U.S. agriculture is predominantly big agribusiness. There are very few family farms in the United States. Many are by large growers. So according to this NAS data that will soon be published, about 72% of farm workers are foreign-born, and about 78% are Hispanic. But there are a number of farm workers. I think we often tend to think of farm workers as Latino, and the vast majority are Latino. But we also have to keep in mind that there are farm workers who are Haitian, who are African American, who are white, who are Asian, Asian American. So it's a much more diverse population than we may think. But the vast majority are Latino. But of that Latino population, about 67% are Mexican. They come from Mexico, the foreign-born population. Those who are U.S.-born, it's also a majority Mexican population. But even within that Mexican population, even within that Latino population, there are a growing number from Central American countries like Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. And there are also a growing number of indigenous farm workers who come from indigenous areas of Mexico and Guatemala and speak an indigenous language like Mixteco and Zapotec and Mam, and they speak Spanish as a second language. And then they speak English as a third language. So there are many language barriers, which I think, you know, definitely contributes to the lack of access to healthcare, which contributes to food security, which contributes to diabetes, and so on and so forth. To look at 2012 data, the average individual income was about $15,000 to $17,499. So they are a low-income population, not surprising. About 25% of farm worker families had incomes below 100% of the federal poverty level. In farm worker communities, it always... And it shocks me every time, and I've said this a lot, but it always shocks me. So some studies have reported that up to 82% of farm workers experience food insecurity. It's ironic. It's extremely ironic that those families, those individuals who harvest the fruits and vegetables that we eat to keep ourselves healthy, that they don't have access to those healthy foods. It's extremely ironic and it's extremely sad. And there's so much that can be done. But I think what we have to understand is food security is not in a bubble. There are these social determinants that occur that influence the ability to be food secure. And in farm worker communities, some of the social determinants include income, because they're low-wage workers, and healthy food is expensive. Fruits and vegetables are expensive, so it's cheaper to buy low-nutrient food, correct? Immigration status is huge. So approximately 46%, according to the most recent data, are undocumented. But some data has it as high as 70%. So a majority of the farm worker population is undocumented, which means that they can't access SNAP. They can't access a lot of nutrition assistance programs or health assistance programs like the marketplaces or the under the Affordable Care Act or Medicaid. In California, there are more options, but that's not true in other states. And also having fear of just driving, they may not have access to driver's licenses. In some states they do. In California, they now do. But, you know, there's immigration status creates a huge barrier in terms of just access to anything. Their living and working conditions are poor. And their living conditions tend to be crowded. I don't know how many of you have gone to a farm worker camp, but they tend to be overcrowded. They tend to be substandard. There is an inadequate amount of food storage, which means that they can't even store the foods that they may want to store, like fruits and vegetables, milk, medicines. There sometimes is not proper refrigeration inside the home, and they also tend to be about maybe 10 people in a trailer and stuff. In some communities. So, you know, you have to think about pest infestation and other issues that may lead to food insecurity. The working conditions are tough, and they are exposed to pesticides. They are exposed to occupational health hazards. And, you know, if a worker wants to eat a piece of fruit from the field, and they likely wouldn't, but some may, because they are working on a piece rate. So they are working to actually, you know, make an income, and they don't take breaks because they want to make as much money as they possibly can in that period of time. If they do have like a piece, if they're in an apple orchard, let's say, and they decide to take an apple that maybe the grower wouldn't want to sell, so they decide to take it, there may be pesticides. Actually, there likely are pesticides on that apple. So we have to think about the pesticide exposure, not just on the fruits and vegetables that they may or may not eat, but also the pesticides that they're exposed to just being in the field and by living adjacent to fields. So pesticides, work conditions, and then, of course, transportation, lack of transportation, living in a rural community. Grocery stores are few and far between. Many end up going to Walmart, which actually does have a great selection of fruits and vegetables. But again, getting there is challenging. So all of that is to say that you can't think of food security as one piece. It's all connected in a greater community in terms of the different influences that may be the reason why a worker or his or her children may or may not be food insecure. Likely food insecure. About their health care, about 68% have no form of health insurance. And only about 20% went to a community health center in 2015. And only about 39% had a U.S. healthcare visit in the last 2 years. So it's a cycle, right? So if you don't go to the doctor, then you may not be connected to medicines or even legal services. Some health centers have legal services professionals who are there to help these families connect to food pantries, connect to food stamps, connect to other resources in their communities in order to have what they need to be healthy. Of course, this will be no surprise, a high incidence of diabetes and hypertension, which again is connected to food security, but then one causes the other and it's cyclical, right? So, you know, you are hypertensive because you don't have access to healthy food, but then you don't have access to healthy food, so you're hypertensive. And so one causes the other and it's a give and take. And then, of course, with children, that's a huge issue, as was already discussed. I do want to point out that farm worker kids do work in the fields, and you can be as young as 12 and legally work in the fields here in the United States. So with that, I will conclude, and I will turn it over to our next speaker.
That concerning information. I feel like there are like a million story possibilities bubbling up here from all three speakers, and we're going to add a lot more with Rosalia. Take it away.
So my name is Rosalia Omungo, and I am a TV reporter for Kenya Broadcasting Corporation. I also serve as the editor for features, health, science, and environment at the same station. So I have my own feature program, which I initiated. It's called EcoWatch. It was at first called EarthWatch. Then the name now became EcoWatch to encompass all those aspects of the environment. And so that is that's my principal product of the station, and that is what I contribute to besides being the editor for environment. And so for food security in Kenya, it's so different from what Alexis says about the United States, that it's mostly it's about agribusiness. So for Kenya, it's the exact opposite. Most of the farmers are subsistence farmers, mm-hmm. and therefore grow crops in their own little farms. Sometimes just to make a living from it. Therefore, my coverage on these food security issues is usually mostly regional, because different regions have different different rainfall patterns. So some are dry regions, some are flooded regions. Therefore, the food security in those situations differ a lot. Some are suffering from floods sweeping away their crops, and others are suffering from lack of rain for one full year. Okay, so in covering food security, I basically consider all those, the aspects that, the elements that constitute food security, which is sufficiency, quality, safety, access, and variety. And some of the factors that influence include, you know, socioeconomic factors. So like, if we even take, for example, in this room, if we move 25 miles radius of this room, you know, the food patterns will change, mm-hmm. you know, and people's food consumption patterns change. So those are some of the factors that affect, you know, people's choices, because some have religious factors. We don't eat this food because of this. Some are just family issues, some are just choices, and some are basically regional. So I'll show you one story. Sorry. It's an example of the sort of stories that I do in Kenya.
Do you want to tell us about your story?
And so if we have time, we can... About the story, if it comes on, then probably watch it. So this lady in the story represents several other Kenyan farmers. Sorry?
He's trying to get back.
Okay.
Can you get someone?
Yeah, somebody's coming. Try to find somebody.
Okay.
Yeah, so the lady in the story represents the 80% of the population that are subsistence farmers in Kenya, and who basically produce crops for their use at home. And that is what farming has been all along in Kenya, but now it's being taken as, you know, an agribusiness, and now the youth are even getting interested in getting into agriculture. But before then, it was not like a business. So right now, farming is being, you know, marketed as not only a means of food production, but also a business. So in my story reporting, I always highlight, you know, in depth, I look for solutions that can be replicated in other places. You know, what are the regional factors affecting a place? Like, that story was based in Kisumu, which is in the western region of Kenya. It is next to Lake Victoria, yet there's not very much use being put to that lake, because it's still a dry region, so that farmers get little crop out of it, and this over reliance of maize as a crop. So farmers have been relying on maize production, yet there are other crops that could do well in such a region, such as sorghum. So this community, this lady represents a group in the community that, through training, they were able now to, you know, focus on things that can work for them. So those are solutions that can work, which is like growing sorghum crop that is also nutritious, and that is able to withstand the climatic conditions in that area. Yeah, despite the fact that they are not putting the lake to good use, because if the policies were better, then they would be able to put, they'd be able to, you know, access water for irrigation. So I also highlight best practices. What are people doing that have helped improve lives? I have another story of flooding, you know, just within the same region, maybe differences of some miles. One side is so dry and one side gets flooding because it's flat. So farmers have devised ways in which using gullies, they are able to, you know, trap the water in floods and you put it to use later. And those are basically community-driven, you know, solutions. Yeah, and also the fact that farming is now a business venture. Another story that I did was in Machakos, also constrained by its regional position. It's in the eastern area, a semi-arid region, an area that goes for months without rain, so that their basic activity is sand harvesting. They have dry beds, you know, they have rivers of sand. There's a lot of seasonal rivers, so all they have is sand, you know, throughout the year. So they do a lot of sand harvesting, which further degrades the land. But some of farmers in a certain community also realized through the extension workers that they were not using certified seeds to do their crops. And when that happened, now some people realize that they can actually, you know, this region can actually be, you know, a basket, you know, a bread basket instead of a region that relies on handouts. Machakos region in Kenya is known for, you know, relying on relief food, you know, parts of the year, and people go with trucks and they line up and they're given relief food, and that now becomes their way of life, but they're now moving from that. So what has helped is the segments in my workplace have really helped to sustain the reportage of this, like Farm Talk and EcoWatch. So what other media in Kenya? So some of the consequences and also how I incorporate that in my reportage. And one of them is devolution. Okay, Kenya has a new system of governance, which is decentralized. Mm. And the centralized system of governance made some communities really poor, so that they were not able to access, you know, infrastructure. Their communities known for just, you know, insecurity, and they are also dry. So there's insecurity, there is insecurity, then there is food insecurity. There is poor infrastructure, there is low education. So there's so many factors that just make the counties poor. And therefore, so when the devolved system of governance came in place, so some of these counties have now gotten allocation, you know, they've gotten access to funds in their own counties and now are able to develop themselves. And this has changed some of the food security measures. Countries that were relying on agriculture are now asking for money, you know, to put up freezers because they are in a region where they can find fish. Okay, so how does other media present some of this?
And I'm just going to interrupt. Sorry.
Sorry?
How long is your film clip?
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Mm.
Do we have time?
I'm just winding up this one.
We can hook it up.
What are you hooking up?
It's a clip. I'm
playing
it.
Off the Mac?
Yeah.
Off the computer?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. So, but how does some of the media report on food security and public health issues as crisis, you know? So when a crisis happens, then we jump into it. And that's it, without follow-ups. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there are examples of stories that I pointed out, you know? Like there was a public health nightmare in one of the counties, which is a dry county. It's called Baringo, which had not had rain for about a year. So the livestock were also affected. Mm-hmm. So community members decide, okay, why don't we... our livestock are dying. So instead of them dying, let's make this one meat. So it became a public health crisis because the meat was poisoned and people ate it and they were hospitalized. Yeah, so that was one. So that's one of the ways in which media reports on this public health and food security crisis. Sometimes when it's a crime issue, okay, so there was an issue when unscrupulous traders in Kenya were hawking milk that was suspected of having hydrogen peroxide. So they were adding poison to milk and then hawking it. So that the milk is a lot. So that was unearthed by the Ministry of Health, and also a case of fake yogurt. There was a case where some traders were selling fake yogurt, in the sense that they were making yogurt. So the media unearthed a syndicate of them making fake yogurt using corn base and not milk. As crime stories without follow-ups. So some of these issues can actually be followed up. There was one story of farmers discarding their milk because it went bad, because the government was not collecting. So another case of, you know, poor policies. Government not collecting milk when it's overproduced, therefore it goes bad. And then what happens later, there is shortage of milk in the country and the government has to import powdered milk. Yeah, so that's one of the other stories, but just done as a, you know, as a news story or a crime beast. So what I'd like to say is that the environment and agriculture beats have helped to, you know, to sustain my reportage in food security and public health. Yeah, and that's how it should be.
Thank you, and I'm sorry about our audiovisual technical issues,
okay.
But I think you did a great job of sort of giving us a vivid picture
it's on
of the
YouTube?
Landscape.
Yes.
So we can look it up on YouTube on our own later.
Later on.
So I think since we really do need to be out of this room apparently at 12:15 mm-hmm. on time, I'm going to just open it up to questions, because I'm guessing that all of you have plenty of questions. If things flag, I've got some in reserve. But SEJ house rules is SEJ members get to ask questions first. Please identify yourself when you ask a question, and questions, not speeches, please. So,
one last thing for the rest of the panel, if you could use the microphones, please.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
That means it's moving back and forth.
Okay. Yeah. So, thank you for the reminder.
My name is Jenny Garfield, and I'm a Scripps Fellow at University of Colorado Boulder. This question is for Rosalia. Mm-hmm. I've spent time in Ethiopia and have sort of followed the massive change in recent years as in agricultural practices in Ethiopia, as massive Chinese companies have come in, bought up huge tracts of land from local farmers, and are now basically putting in huge soy plantations all over the east of the country. And I'm wondering, you didn't directly discuss anything about that in your presentation. I'm wondering if that is an issue that you're seeing in Kenya, and if you can tell that if that's the case, what extent you're seeing that in Kenya.
Okay, so about the Chinese are flooding Ethiopia and taking up the land. Yes, I was actually following on a story on, it was related to the Omo River. Yeah, about lots of land has been put to that use. So for Kenya, they have actually not invaded that space. The space that the Chinese have invaded is the construction business, you know, and other businesses. Agriculture still remains within government domain and subsistence farmers. Yes. Yeah, so that's what I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Chuck?
How, the American U.S. growers higher profile again with some of the debate over trade deals. Mm-hmm. How are they doing in general? How are the U.S. growers and food companies doing in addressing some of the concerns that have been raised by this panel? I'm from Wisconsin, Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin's a gag state, big ag business.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll attempt to answer that question. I think it really depends. There is a movement towards corporate social responsibility. I know Farm Worker Justice, we are a part of a corporate social responsibility project called the Equitable Food Initiative, which is working with growers as well as those who buy the fruits and vegetables. So the larger, I think, well, I don't want to name names of who's a part of it because I can't remember off the top of my head. But the larger suppliers who buy the fruits and vegetables. And the goal is to also involve the workers, to have standards so that the workers are involved not only in the you know, their own health in terms and well-being in terms of wages and the working conditions, but also if they have a voice at the table, and that they're represented, that their viewpoint is represented. So, you know, some growers are moving in that direction. And there are some growers, here in California who do have health clinics, on their farms. Many do work with, you know, some, health centers or others to try to connect their workers. But I think what's important to note is that there's a large number, a growing number of labor contractors who are working with the workers and moving them from farm to farm. And that that allows the grower to be somewhat separate, because the grower hires the contractor hires the workers, the contractor therefore in the minds of some growers are responsible for everything, which means that they can take a step back and not have that responsibility. It's a challenge, but some growers are trying to do the right thing.
And people are curious about the food, what is it, Equitable Food Initiative. I'm not completely up to date on who the current partners are, but I did a story on this a couple years ago, and the one retailer who would talk to me for the story at the time was Costco. Mm-hmm. And they were very interested in this, and they were working on it at the time. I think strawberries were one of the products that they were involved in, and sort of interestingly from sort of a journalistic angle, Costco, because one of the things they told me is that because they don't advertise, and they felt they were kind of at liberty to sort of make some moves in directions that some other companies might not, but it's a great thing to look into for story, particularly for regional stories. So, other questions? Yeah. Oh, wait, there's one, and I won't throw it in. Go ahead.
For Rosalia, is there an online program where we can look at your posts? Because I didn't catch the title.
Yes, I'll send a link. I have several links.
You should put it in the hashtag.
Yeah, why don't you, the question was about the film clips. If you, are you on Twitter? You could put it on Twitter, put the link on Twitter with the hashtag SUJ 2016. Yeah. And one question that I wanted to ask Zoe in sort of the healthcare arena, I was at a presentation, I guess maybe this summer, with a physician, actually also California-based, who was talking about the issues around asking about income status and food access issues in the healthcare arena. And I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about that, about is it okay to ask those questions? And, I mean, in terms of also sort of journalism, when you're kind of wondering about people that you're talking to in impacted communities, you know, what's considered okay to ask professionally, or how do you get at those questions without making assumptions and things like that?
So I think that most questions are sort of allowable in healthcare. You know, we ask folks about very intimate things, both, you know, health-wise as well as living, you know, your safety, you know, is someone hurting you? Are you fearful that someone's hurting you? So I think that in terms of physicians feeling like they can't ask those questions, I don't think that's a barrier. In some states, there are some legal restrictions on what pediatricians and physicians can ask. Specifically in Florida, we're not allowed to ask if there's a gun in the home.
Really?
Yes. It's none of our business, apparently. If your child gets shot by your gun, it's not our business. But I think the biggest barrier, quite honestly, for physicians asking those questions is, what if I get a positive answer? So what if the patient says to me, yeah, actually, I do run out of food every single month. And then I go, what do I do with that? And certainly if I've never been trained to ask the question, I really have never been trained on where to get information on how to help people. And how awful is that to then say, wow, I'm sorry, and not know who to refer the patient to, or not have the resources in my office to refer patients for that. In most pediatricians' office, unless you're a federally qualified health clinic, you can't bill for services provided by mental health professionals. So most of those sorts of answers are, in terms of resource acquisition and resource referral, are done by social workers. And so most, even though to be considered a medical home, you're supposed to have a social worker in your office, most have a referral to a social worker. So I think the bigger barrier is actually knowing where to send people when you get a positive answer.
I wonder if you could just take a little time to talk some more about sort of really important research questions that, you know, are connected to sort of addressing food production, making food production more climate-proof, things like that. And talk about who's doing them, who's doing the research. Is it universities? Is it, you know, international organizations? Is it sort of network policy?
Yeah, it's a really important time to be asking targeted questions in this arena, both in building resilience to food systems or climate change, but also making sure the poor maintain or are resilient as well as some of the bigger, the wealthier countries. Some of the questions I think that are really the most important is how do interventions, whatever they are, or new practices to build resilience, what are the outcomes? What's the outcome in terms of productivity? What's the outcomes in terms of productivity under extreme conditions? Because that's really, we're finding there's more and more studies that are coming out that are showing us that many of the crops that we use intensively in the upper Mississippi basin that are GMOs are not resilient under climate change, and they actually have decreased yields under periods of drought relative to their non-GMO counterparts. And I think that asking the question, what are yields, well, how do those yields vary under different conditions, what are the practices, the soil health practices and the conservation agriculture practices that can increase yields and confer resilience, and who do they, where and how do those work, under what conditions, under what cultures, under what sort of rights-based systems, under what kind of farming practices do they do that? And that is one of the things that we are trying to do in the CARE Alliance, is we have found just amazing variability to very simple interventions, no-till or conservation agriculture, which is about some organic amendments and no-till, and it really depends who's doing the farming, when the season is, what their water rain patterns look like, whether they have seeds that are appropriate for the space, for that particular place, and how that changes over time, all is very different from place to place. And being able to document that in a systematic way and come up with generalities will help us better define the kinds of programs that can actually be put in place much more quickly to ensure that we can increase nutritious food production in the future. And I want to make this point about nutritious foods, because we think about here nutritious foods being, you know, over processed foods, and processed foods are not nutritious. People don't have access to healthy fruits and vegetables. In the developing world, it's the it's the grains that are becoming, and the choice of grains from say millet to or some sorghum to maize, that decreases the nutritional value, and then some of the processing to increase yields increases the increase yields or calories, decreases the nutritional value per unit of grain. And so those things are really important to look at, because we, as we say, we don't just care about calories, even though that has been the focus of many of our global food programs for years and years and years. We care about nutrition, and we know more now than we've ever known about how important certain types of nutrition are for growth and health of children and females and for reproduction. And so it's really important that when we're thinking about these research questions, that we're using culturally appropriate grains, not grains in the places that are nutritious varieties, not just calorie-rich varieties.
And I've got a follow-up to that really interesting bit of information that I didn't quite realize, that increasing, working with the type of grain that's being grown to increase its yield to, as a calorie yield, can decrease the nutritional value, which kind of makes intuitive sense. But what are the obstacles or challenges to countering that trend?
I think a big part of it is information. There's you can't imagine the flood of aid that has come into getting certain kinds of grains into certain kind of places for production, because the focus has been on yield and not on nutrition for many, many, many years. I think when you begin to focus in food programs globally, are beginning to focus more on nutrition and more on culturally appropriate grains, that you'll begin to see that you'll have food production happen in a different way. It won't be one size fits all for all places. But you'll have food production and the development of seeds that are nutritious, that are climate resistant, and that are done in sort of breeding, using breeding mechanisms that local communities can actually control, as opposed to being manufactured and sold from, en masse from developed countries through big agribusiness. And I think the information that actually begins to feed into local development, appropriate development of food supplies is going to be really important, and it'll change. It's a really an optimistic time in thinking about this stuff, because we have more information now, every single one of us, than we did 15 years ago connecting the dots, and these gaps are being highlighted over and over again. It's such a rich area, and now you can actually begin to ask questions we didn't even know to ask,
sure,
10 or 15 years ago. And so and once you can ask those questions, you can begin to act on them. You can begin to build programs around it. And so this is why this alliance we have found so enriching for our work, because it really is a way of meeting the goals of the food security goals of the world's poor. At the same time, you're underpinning the environmental piece of it that will ensure long-term productivity, both for environment and for people.
Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
Lauren from WWF. I'm wondering if some of the big movements that we've seen in some of the first world media about, be it organic or animal welfare or non-GMO, how that's affecting food security in general, and then in your individual areas in particular, if that's making any kind of ripple effect, if there's misinformation, what kind of things you're seeing?
Wow.
You
guys can go first. Well, I'll just say organics are really interesting, because organics are important. It took a long time for the organics industry to really get up to speed, and it got up to speed. It's getting up to speed. There's still some problems in the way organics are produced in many places, and one of the key things is there's not a focus on soil health, and so you're still having soil degradation, soil erosion, which overall, long term, will undermine the food production system. And so we do need to, that is a food security issue, right? That you think organic does it all, it doesn't do it all. But now the great thing is we know organic doesn't do it all. We have great studies that tell us how we need to improve on organic, how we need to improve in terms of higher production of, you know, of organic, and what the role of animal welfare in creating productive but also GMOs are not they just aren't a panacea. They haven't increased the yields that under all conditions that we thought that they would. They can certainly lend some increased productivity on a short term, but over the long term, it hasn't been proven out. There was a study on GMOs that came out at the National Academy of Science where pretty much says, like, none of the really bad stuff everybody's saying is true according to the scientific basis, and none of the good stuff is really true either. It's just sort of a wash. And it's sort of, if it's a wash and the systems that use GMOs actually undermine the long term resilience of the system because it undermines or degrades the environment, the farming practices do, then this is a real issue for us to look at in terms of food security. And one thing I do want to say about the U.S. is we don't have a food program. We have a SNAP. We have a farming and agriculture program, but we don't have a food safety program we have food safety programs, but we don't have a food program that pulls all that together and says, what kind of food system do you need to truly be food secure as a nation and then protect the poor in that context? We don't have that. And it's there's a lot of cool debate going on about whether we should have one or what that would look like. And I think it's a really interesting space.
And I would encourage all the journalists, if you are working on any stories around food security issues, food security and climate change issues, food security and particularly food access issues, and you're talking to USDA, ask them about that. Ask them about what kind of work they're doing to look at the U.S. food system holistically that includes not only the large-scale growers, but what they call the growers, small-scale growers, particularly of specialty crops, which is basically everything that all of us eat. I'm not accounting for meat, but basically everything that we think of eating, because you'll get some surprising answers. And I've asked this question, and the answer that I've gotten so far is, oh, we should be looking at that. So I would encourage all of you to add that. Yeah.
Just to follow on that, do you know of any country that has a really good food security program that's comprehensive?
I don't. It's a great question, though. I don't know.
Anybody in the room?
The question was what?
Does anybody know of a country that has a food security or a holistic food system that looks at food security and not just kind of production and yield? Okay. Research question, story coming up, assignment is to be made. And I think we've got time for one short question, and then sadly we're going to have to wrap this up. Did you have one? Probably not a short question.
So my answer to that is I don't know. But, you know, because of, you know, drought conditions like here in California, I think that there are discussions because the drought has impacted agriculture. Now, how that is actually, you know, trickling down to the workers, unclear. I think that, you know, workers are impacted by climate change, absolutely, because they have less work, and the work that they do changes. And many workers follow harvests or work seasonally. But there's a disconnect oftentimes between agriculture and the growers and the workers. And I think that there are attempts to close that gap and kind of bring both into conversation. But sometimes there are opposing viewpoints and different challenges arise. But I think that is something that's being discussed in the U.S. because of all the issues, especially with the recent drought and still ongoing drought here in California.
So we're going to have to wrap this up. That is a great question to end on because it makes us all want to talk about this a lot more. And I hope I know that Zoe is here the rest of the day. I think Rebecca and maybe Alexis will be here for a few minutes longer. They're all wonderful sources to talk to for stories. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Rosalia and Alexis, Rebecca and Zoe, for being here. This is a really thought-provoking discussion, so thank you. And now I have to send you back to the ball.